Okay, folks, welcome to the session. My name is Jeff Burnside, the senior investigative reporter at Como TV in Seattle and on your SEJ board. This is the Corporate Green Sustainability Success Stories from the Business World. And one of the reasons I think this is such a fascinating panel is because it's one of the fundamental roles of the journalist is to be the watchdog and hold the powerful accountable, and that often means throughout our history big corporations, sometimes small corporations. But in doing so, we sometimes, I think, miss the great stories that deserve to be told. And this is an opportunity for some of those stories for you to have access to them, to be exposed to them, to ask questions. Our panelists have an interesting story to tell about their individual corporations. And, we're going to save a lot of time for questions because journalists always like that the most. So we're going to go right down the row here. Aaron Meisen is with Interface. And it's a carpet company, as she likes to say, but it's so much more than that, really. If you didn't know already, the issue of carpets and sustainability and environmental issues is a big one. There's carpet everywhere, but they have led this industry for a long, long time. And she's going to tell you about some of the brand new elements that are coming out on her story as well. And then in the middle is Joanna Pickup from Boeing. And as you might imagine, the airline industry is a huge environmental story. Biofuels are on the horizon but aren't here yet. We're going to find out what Boeing is doing about that for its partner customers and what it'll take to make biofuels much more expansive. Also, aerodynamic issues, traffic control issues. Boeing is doing a lot of research in that area. And then on the far end is Microsoft's TJ DiCaprio. You may have seen some of the headlines about her recently because Microsoft is embarking on a carbon neutral mission by the end of the year. They have voluntarily imposed on their individual companies an internal carbon fee to go carbon neutral. It's costing them many millions of dollars. They will save many millions of dollars, but they'll also get a lot more out of it, and we'll ask her about some of those details too. But let's start right here to my right with Aaron Meisen. Aaron?
Great. Thank you. Thanks, Jeff. I'm going to start with a video, and what I really want to talk to you about today is less about all the good things that Interface is doing and much more about what if. So over the last year, we've been working on this really interesting pilot project in the Philippines that, at least for us, has us very excited about us defining and entering that next phase of sustainability. And it's, you know, kind of beyond the 20 years ago mentality of the triple bottom line and just sort of be less bad and lower your impact. And it's really moving us towards what would it mean to do more good. What would it mean to put in place a model for commerce that has positive social impacts, positive environmental impacts that extend well beyond kind of the borders of our company?
The livelihoods of the people in this part of the Philippines is completely dependent upon the sea, one way or another. Dinahan Bank is now one of the most degraded coral reefs in the world with some of the highest fishing pressure. Fishers use, especially in the Philippines, use a lot of monofilament nylon nets. It's when discarded nets go into the marine environment and they just hang around, they can last for 600 plus years.
This is a really high performance engineering plastic. You know, nylon 6 is in our carpet. It's also in lots of other products that people will use every day. So we want to make sure that material can be used again. Networks is a program that takes discarded fishing nets from impoverished communities and recycles them into carpet tile.
The idea is to collect discarded fishing nets off the beaches or get them from fishers as soon as they have finished using them.
What's really important about this program is that it's not a one-shot beach cleanup for some nice pictures. It's actually about how do you institutionalize nets and ultimately other material recycling in communities in a way that benefits them in the long term.
Someday, maabot na gid ang panahon nga mahurot ang sanang pukot galis ka ayunan. Kaya daghan naman nga musundog na mo.
Mga sampul nga gihatag, ipatanaw na mo dire. Ako nakita nga dako dahil kay mahimo ang maong pukot.
The product is still our product. Beautiful carpet tile. It will look the same, but there'll be this story behind the material. This to me is the start of us being a restorative enterprise. We're giving back and giving opportunities that are way beyond what maybe people would think a carpet tile company could do. And this is only the beginning.
right. So that sort of takes you to the next logical... Oops. Did I lose? No, it's okay. Didn't expect you there, right there. this sort of... I can't kind of get out of this now. Sorry, guys. It's like frozen on that screen. Okay. Well, we can look at the pretty picture. It's just kind of frozen. That's okay. I wanted to show the video and talk a little bit about this, and I think it sort of begs the most important question, which is what is an Atlanta-based carpet company doing in the Philippines, and what is this project all about? And, you know, really the project started for us 5 years ago in India. And, you know, the company about 20 years ago had started on this sustainability path and interface, and we had started to ask ourselves, how do we take the company beyond this model of just doing less bad? You know, reducing our footprint. We've been at this about 20 years. What's the next step for corporate sustainability? And we started looking at inclusive business models. We looked very specifically at the World Business Council for Sustainable Development's work, and we asked ourselves, could we pilot a project around an inclusive business model that would bring a product to market? Because that's what we do. We make products and bring them to market. Could we bring a product to market that would embody this sort of next level of inclusive commerce? You know, so it would be an environmentally superior product, but it would also have social benefits. It would also benefit local communities beyond just benefiting our company. So we started in India. We identified a collaborative of women's weavers there and worked to help design and ultimately bring to market, and we launched it in our European market, this amazing product that used traditional skills, local materials. We ultimately brought that to the European market, and it was a huge failure. Nobody wanted to buy it. It was beautiful. It was a fantastic story, but it was fundamentally different than the types of products that we were selling. Those types of nylon products, the products you're looking at right now that your feet are on. And in retrospect, we sort of really challenged ourselves to say, okay, there are a couple pieces of that that were right. And in getting to sort of this idea of what's the next frontier for corporate sustainability, we're going to try and fail 15 more things. You know, 10 more things are going to work. One's really going to hit. So we really took that to heart and said, what's the next iteration of this? And where do we need to improve? One thing that also really bothered us in the beginning when that was launched was this issue of materiality. So when you think about sort of a company pursuing sustainability, it's sort of like a large oil company putting in their sustainability report, we've moved to 100% recycled paper. Yeah, it's fantastic, but completely immaterial. Not at all in line with your impacts. Probably not something you should be working on or talking about. So we said to ourselves, what's the biggest environmental impact we have? How do we target there as it results to product? And about over 80% of the environmental impacts of the carpet products that we make are in the raw materials, are in nylon. So we started asking ourselves, how do we find that? How do we isolate that and find a better way to find a recycled version of that and put in place a system that will actually embody some of those values we want to live up to, that will have social benefits, that will have additional environmental benefits beyond just being a recycled product. So we started working, you know, we started doing research and actually found out in the first 3 months of a pilot product that the same type of nylon that goes into commercial fishing nets is the same nylon we use in our product. And we sort of had a huge light bulb there and said, all right, there's a huge environmental benefit to both bringing back a recycled stream of nylon so that our products can be 100% recycled, but also maybe taking them from places and targeting pilot projects to collect these where they're doing an environmental damage. So that was kind of the genesis behind this project in the Philippines. We launched it initially with a couple communities in partnership with the London Zoological Society. Because when we first identified this, you know, the immediate revelation we had is we don't know where we should be collecting this. We don't know the biggest places in the world where there are ghost fishing nets, where there are discarded fishing nets. We don't know how to work within communities to do that. We make carpet. We're sort of in the middle of the supply chain. And then the back end of it was we knew that our supplier didn't know that as well. You know, we work in partnership with a couple different nylon suppliers around the world. And so we started having dialogues around trying to fill out a partnership that was a much more inclusive model where we could work with partners on the front end who are in these communities, who do work with local organizations, and then some partners on the back end who would actually take the material once it's been sourced and actually make it into a recycled nylon. So we're about a year into the project. We've now expanded it to be over 26 villages in the Philippines around the Danyangbag area, and we're now looking to move into other communities in India as well. So I think it's, you know, for us it's been a real victory after a couple of early things that didn't work, because we're ultimately seeing not just our nets being collected and income is going to local communities. The nets are being baled. There's now a supply agreement in place between those communities and our nylon supplier. We've essentially backed out of the deal because in order for this to be economically sustainable, you know, what needs to happen is that community ultimately needs to be in a sourcing situation with this nylon supplier. So they've signed an agreement. They've agreed upon a price. The first nets have gone back to, over the course of the last 6 months, Aquafil, that nylon supplier, and they are actively recycling that and making recycled fiber that is coming back to us and we're putting it into our products. So to us, it's a sort of fantastic example of how are you looking beyond the horizon to not just kind of doing less bad, but being able to be in a situation as a company and have an influence for more good. You know, do more good. And I was really interested when I read the description for this panel, it talks about the triple bottom line. And to me, I think that was a fantastic concept 20 years ago. You know, its basis was, well, you know, companies are going to look at their bottom line, their profit, but then they also have sort of these other environmental and social considerations. And I think over the last 10, 15, 20 years, large corporations have sort of embraced that model. They've started to come to grips with the environmental side of it, not really come to grips much with the social side of that. What does it mean to have a positive social benefit? And I think the shift in, you know, the thinking has really shifted dramatically beyond that. And no one's talking about it. No one's writing about it. The fact that we're still using that concept of the triple bottom line, which is about 20 years old, is not the kind of thinking, is not the kind of terminology that's going to get us to the next phase. We should be talking about things like inclusive business models. We should be asking companies, how are your products not just more environmentally sensitive or more environmentally positive? We should be asking them, how is the commerce that you're doing going to address poverty? How is it going to address degradation around the world? What are you doing to sort of fundamentally come up with a new business model? Because we can't say we're pursuing corporate sustainability when half of the people in the world still live on less than $2 a day. So I had a couple of slides, but I can come back to that. But I kind of wanted to leave it with that. And that's the dialogue and the conversation I wanted to tee up today. So thank you very much.
Well, let's take a couple of questions for you, and then we'll move on to the next one rather than saving our questions for the very end. And let me just ask the first one, and please think of your questions next. I always hate that awkward moment when no one has a question right at the beginning.
I hate that.
But my question to you, just to start us off, is but if we're going to move beyond the triple bottom line, are we to expect corporations to set aside the considerations for their bottom line, and why would we want to? Why would they do that?
Yeah, I don't think it's setting aside. I think when you looked at that old framework of the triple bottom line, it just assumed that companies had a very conventional definition of profit, right? And then the social and environmental considerations were out here, and that's what leads to the tremendous amount of dollars that companies spend on philanthropy. And, you know, getting in place recycled office paper, which is a fantastic thing to do. But if you're fundamentally not focusing on the biggest impacts you have as a company, you're really sort of not pursuing sustainability. So I think it's a couple things. I don't think it's abandoning or hoping that a company will abandon the desire, the aggressive desire for profit. I think it's that they will kind of redefine what it means to be a profitable enterprise. And I think that means, you know, for us, it's always meant that we think the profits that we have are more justified. We're certainly not any less interested in being a profitable business. And as a publicly traded company, we can't be. You know, David Kohler sits on our board of directors. And so it's very interesting. We have some very business-minded folks. We're not kind of this tiny carpet company that has a bunch of environmental people that serve on our board of directors. We're incredibly profit-minded. But what we've said to ourselves is, if we are in business 15 years from now, if we can maintain a super motivated employee base, if our customers are extremely loyal because of programs like this, we'll make the investment. I think that's the gateway. But then I think what we're seeing on the back end is ultimately there will be a cost benefit to this type of supply arrangement. I mean, what's very interesting is right now it's a tiny bit more expensive to use recycled nylon than it is virgin nylon. But it's a huge hedge if we could put in place a system to guarantee those recycled materials for the next 10 years with our supplier, fix a price, and negotiate that fixed price at a very sort of positive level because they're getting a huge amount of PR about this project. So I think it's really about redefining what does it sort of mean to be profitable and looking at some of those other intangibles that kind of really make a difference.
That's a big leap for any organization, an established organization. Oh, so how did you get that started? Who was the main motivator?
Yeah. That's a good question. She said that's just a huge leap, and it is. We've been at this about 20 years. So my company is about 40 years old. It was founded by an entrepreneur, actually a Georgia Tech grad. So it's actually founded in LaGrange, Georgia, in Atlanta. And about 20 years into the life of its company, he was 60 years old. And it was the early 90s. We had a huge project in California, and customers were starting to get aware about green building. And they were asking us, what's your company doing for the environment? And we were like, you know, we're following all the laws. Because people weren't talking about sustainability back then, and people weren't selling things like recycled content. The U.S. Green Building Council didn't exist. You had sort of these companies who were starting these projects, and so we lost the job. And it was a huge impact to our founder at the time, because that's sort of the lifeblood of the company. So he created a task force, which companies will do. Oh, we got to get like five guys together to figure out what we're going to do about this. And they sort of turned it back on him and said, all right, we'll come up with an answer. We'll come up with an environmental vision for this company, but you got to come kick it off with a speech. And he says, you know, to this day, he had said, I've sweated it. It was kind of the most dreadful thing, thinking about what I was going to say. I just wasn't in the right mindset. And a couple weeks before, a book landed on his desk by Paul Hawken called The Ecology of Commerce. And he read it, and he describes having sort of an epiphanal experience. It just fundamentally changed his thinking. And the book, you know, if you've never read the book sort of details, we're going to hell in a handbasket. I mean, every natural system is in decline. Who's the culprit? Yeah, it's business. But the really hopeful part of the book and the part that stuck with our founder was business is the institution that is powerful enough to change it. So he sort of became a changed person, showed up to that meeting, completely stunned everybody, and said, from this day forward, this company is going to be the new industrial model. And we are going to be about not just doing less bad, but with an ultimate goal of having a restorative impact. So it started with the founder. He got the CEO on board. And over the course of the next, you know, we've been at it about 19 years. Over the course of the next 15 years, he consistently took that message and drove it in the business. And so it really was one mind at a time. lots of people in the company thought, oh, Mr. Anderson's gone crazy. He's getting old. He's going to forget about this, you know. And so he did three things really well. He was super passionate about it. You could tell when he stood up at every factory around the world and said, I think we have a role to play in something beyond just making carpet. And that resonated with our people. He was really consistent. You know, he went to every single factory, every single meeting. The economy went up, it went down, you know, markets dried up, and he basically said, we're going to keep doing this. And the third thing he did is he brought all these amazing outside people in to really inspire and change our thinking. Because, you know, the company had no idea when he said to a bunch of operations guys, we're going to be sustainable. And they just sort of said, well, give us the plan, because we don't even know what that means. So he reached out to Paul Hawken. He wrote Paul a letter and said, I read your book. I'm a CEO. I've been in this business 20 years. I can only imagine the environmental damage my company has done, but we're going to turn it around and I want you. And then they started recruiting people. Amory Lovins, Janine Benias with Biomimicry came on board to help advise us. One of the original founders of the Sierra Club. And he started bringing these people, to our meetings, and would have them talk about what sustainability really means. And so I can say sort of, you know, it's interesting. When I was in business school, Interface was a case study at Dartmouth Business School. They were a case study. And, you know, 15 years later, I'm working for them, and I always remembered that. And they were this one case study as a company who's really done it. So that was the original transformation, and he drove it so deep within the culture of the company that it's never really changed. He passed away, unfortunately, 2 years ago, but it was never a question that we wouldn't keep going. We've sort of turned the corner. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we've done an initial. So we do an LCA on all of our products, and it's actually all now public through environmental product declarations. You can actually download them based on any product. And what we kind of found is obviously nylon is the biggest impact in the sourcing side of it. We're incredibly efficient assemblers. About 84% is all on the getting the nylon out of the environment before it comes to us and making it into a fiber. And so what's fantastic about that is automatically around the recycling end, you get sort of the much lower impact when you're not taking virgin. But right now, we've only had sort of three iterations of nets being collected, baled, and sent up to our yarn supplier. And so the question we're trying to answer critically is we suspect that there's obviously a huge environmental reduction there by not taking virgin but bringing recycled. But then you have to factor in, okay, how much energy does it take to actually ship this to Italy? How much energy does it take, which would be additional if they were processing it and cleaning it? So we're actually in the middle of doing that right now with our supplier. And on the products that we have just released, there's not enough of it in them yet, but the next iteration of those products, so next spring, we should have environmental product declarations that will show that based on the LCA data. And just what we've heard anecdotally is they've said, you know, there's not a lot of processing of these, so we don't suspect there's a huge looming energy thing that we're not seeing. So we feel good about that end of it. But I don't know if it'll be like 80 to 40.
Thanks for having me. Identify yourself and affiliation.
Hey! So she asked about sort of what's the level of acceptance in the communities and can we document and measure how it's actually changing lives. And the first is I have a great slide deck, which I couldn't get up. after the video that shows how many people are participating in how many villages that I'll be happy to send you. And so I think the quick answer to that is really positive acceptance, surprisingly positive. And our partner, the Zoological Society of London, is really kind of the on-the-ground project manager. But what you kind of have to understand about this pilot project in particular is most of the people who are getting an additional income by collecting these nets and turning them in, their main income, their subsistence relies on the health of that reef and the ocean right there. So a lot of them are fishing for food, or a lot of them are fishing to put the fish into the tropical fish trade. So those two, so the vast majority of people that we're talking to already depend on the quality, having a high quality marine environment for that first part. So this to me is just sort of second. You know, it's a secondary way to make that link. But the initial response in the community has been really positive. And one of the reasons was in a couple of these villages, there was no existing financing system to begin with. So, you know, sort of one of the challenges is, this project itself has not sort of brought an environmental impact and also an additional financial positive impact to those people. It's put in place a system where they're not just getting an income, they're getting an ability to bank that, to do something about it. You know, so it's been a really interesting sort of walk through that, and we have some statistics about how much the average person gets out of it, how many families are impacted, which are on the great PowerPoint that froze. So I will, I'll get it to all of you guys so you can see it. And it's quite small. I mean, I want to be really humble about the fact that right now it's in 26 villages. So it's a couple hundred people, right? It's not a huge change the world yet. But the model itself, if it's financially viable, is a huge change the world thing. Because what if not just Interface, what if every company who used nylon, what if everyone in our industry did it? What if every other company who sourced a raw material thought about it and did something similar?
One last question, then we're going to move on. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm Renee Speak. I'm a freelancer from Washington, D.C. Hearing your talk made me think about that great garbage dump.
Yeah, right by Midway, yeah.
And I'm just curious if businesses have looked at it at all in terms of monetizing.
The garbage patch?
Yeah, I think you see Chris Jordan's photographs, and how can you not sort of, you know, have you guys all seen those with the albatross? Yeah. You know, that's a good question. We haven't.
It's a mix of garbage.
Yeah. It's always, when I always see those albatross pictures, I see bottle caps and lighters, the plastic lighters. And I think if I were probably in one of those companies, I would feel very strongly compelled to ask, how do we sort of trace back that problem? But no, I mean, we sort of haven't gotten there. And one thing we noticed with the India project, and we're doing some experimentation with bio-based yarns, is one thing we really struggled with is the further it gets outside of your direct and immediate impacts, the challenge you have to make a great financial business model. So I talked about that project in India, which was natural woven materials, local artisan skills, really great guild we could work with, but we didn't really understand that business model. And so when I think about that, I think about who has the opportunity to really understand the financial implications of salvaging that, for lack of a better word, sorting it, and to me it sort of argues for a plastics recycler or a company that sort of really has looked at what's the financial value of A, removing this from the marine environment, and B, is there anything we can do with it?
Thank you very much. Let's give her a round of applause, shall we? Erin, thank you very much. In fact, some journalists should start asking questions about those Bic lighter manufacturers and find out who's going to be the first one to come up with a more biodegradable one. Okay, second up is Joanna Pickup, is with the Boeing Company. And Joanna, have at it.
Hi, it's great to be here. And I'm just going to apologize ahead of time. Jeff asked me to do this a couple hours ago. So
we had one of our speakers broke his foot last night.
Yeah.
And
so
she kindly stepped in.
So a little on the fly, one of the things I wanted to talk today to all of you about is the sort of the breadth of the Boeing environmental story that you all are probably familiar with our fuel-efficient aircraft or with our biofuel story. But one of the things I wanted to share with you guys today is that that's sort of the second and third step down the line where our environmental story begins. The environment is part of the conversation at initial concept design, not just on our commercial aircraft, but in military and our technology. And just wanted to show you a couple minute quick video about that because they can say it a lot better than I can.
You said it's about a 2 minute video?
It's about 2 minutes. Hopefully it'll play.
I saw zeros on there.
Come on. It played earlier. Well. Okay, so that's not going to work.
It's actually me. I have bad electronics karma. Everything that's around me doesn't work. Pardon me?
Okay, well, that if that doesn't work, let's see if this one works. I had a backup just in case. Just in case, let's see if this one works.
Thinking, which is a good thing.
Well, okay. So apparently, I don't get a video to tell my story. that's okay. That's okay. If you were to watch the first video, our director of a program called Design for Environment, Gina Yu, would have been speaking and talking to you guys about how when we come up with a concept for a new airplane or a new process, the shift for the environment and the conversation has really transformed over the past, I would say, 20 years. And it used to be about, well, how can we recycle? We have an airplane, and so the second video was going to be all about aircraft recycling. And that's where the focus, you know, really used to be about a decade ago, is how can we recycle our products at end of use? Now it's shifted into when we design an airplane, how can we incorporate environmental considerations into the initial design? So maybe that's carbon fiber. Maybe that's using lighter weight advanced aluminum alloys in larger pieces. It's partnering with our suppliers. In the Design for Environment video, there was actually a piece about a partnership we did with a carpet company to do, if you can imagine an airplane's in service for 20, 30 years and all the wear and tear the carpet has on the floor. And most up until recently, all the carpet was a single piece. And if there was a stain or it was torn, you'd have to rip out all the carpet and replace all of it. That's a lot of waste. And so we partnered with a company to come
up
with Interface to do tile squares. And so now if there's a stain or a tear, the airline company can just replace that one square and made out of recycled materials, and that can be disposed of instead of all the carpet being taken out. So I've been at the company. I'll just tell you a little about me. I've been with the company for about 5.5 years. I've worked on our defense side, our commercial side, and our corporate division, and I can tell you that environmental considerations is really at the heart of the company, that we've been around for almost 100 years, and at Boeing, you won't necessarily hear us use the word sustainability. What you will hear us talk about is creating a sustainable future, that we've been around for almost 100 years, you know, we plan on being around for 100 plus more years, and looking to the future and what can make that a better future, not just for our company, but for the environment, for the communities in which we serve, that's truly in our best interest. And now more and more we're starting to talk about all the stuff that we do. We have a department that's just focused on what we call global corporate citizenship. I work in our environment, health, and safety group. But one of the things, I actually was talking to TJ earlier, and she reminded me of something that I wasn't even going to talk about. But in one of our buildings, we have something called the Viz Room or the Visibility Room. And along the walls are all of the different teams. So when we make a decision, we have someone who sits at the table, everything from product design through manufacturing, supplier management, from our customers through end of use. And we all get together at the table and talk about what's the best decision. So it might be the best decision from an operational perspective, but it's not going to have the best impact for our customers. We all get together and come up with what's the best long-term solution, and then we go through as all large corporations do, the return on investment analysis for everything. If you've worked at a big company like Microsoft, everything's about a business case and it's not just looking like at that triple bottom line. It's sort of moved past that and it's about what's really the right decision. When it comes to the environment, if my videos were working, I could have shown you another video. Our factory in South Carolina, which just opened last year, our newest manufacturing facility where we build the 787 Dreamliners. It's our first facility to be powered on 100% renewable energy. It has one of the nation's largest solar panels. When we put our solar panel roof on the factory, we doubled the solar power capacity in the state of South Carolina. It's one of 5 zero waste to landfill sites. One of the changes sort of in the culture is now that when we have new construction, it has to be LEED certified silver or better. That's something that the company has decided is important because we're going to be around for a long time. If we look at our facility in Everett, it was built in the late 1960s. It's still there. It's still growing. The products that we make and the way we make them has a lasting impact on not just the earth, but on the people that we employ. And a lot of the environmental improvements that we've made over the years come from our employees. Before I had this role, I used to work on the 747 airplane program, and the best part of my job was going down on the factory floor every day and talking to our employees. And some of our best environmental ideas come from them, and they're super passionate, not just about making an amazing product, but making it better and making it more environmentally progressive. And that also is about recycling. I'll just share a story. 5 years ago in 2007, we set our first environmental targets for the company, which was great. Boeing, yeah, we have all these targets. And we just got flooded with emails from employees about, well, I can't recycle. So is the company really genuine about this? Because every day when they showed up to work, they had a Coke can. They couldn't recycle that. They could go home and recycle it, but they couldn't do it at work. And so there was a lot of conversations internally about, well, are we really genuine with this? Is it just a PR stunt? Do we really mean this? And so over the course of the past 5 years, we've gone from almost no recycling to an enhanced recycling program to composting, where now if you're at work, you can recycle everything and you can compost right at your facility. And so sort of looking at all those small touch points are also just as important as the way we build the products is how our employees show up and the things that they see every day, because they're the ones that have the really great ideas about improving environmental performance. My husband's an engineer for Boeing, and he spends his time redesigning the engine cowlings. And all what he does is he makes the engine more efficient, and that reduces drag, and that makes it more fuel efficient for our customers. And we have conversations that some days he has a more environmentally directed job than I do. And my job is to talk about in the environment. But he lives that day in and day out, and we see that at Boeing, that you don't need to be in the environmental department to have an environmental job. That whether you work on the line or you're our CEO, you have a responsibility to be coming forward with innovative solutions to make tomorrow better, because that's going to make our company better and that's going to keep us around for the next 100 years. And also we're in a very competitive environment, that if we don't adapt, if we don't change, if we don't make everything better and better every day, we're not going to be around, because our customers demand it, the public demands it, our employees demand it, and there's a strong team at Boeing that's spends a lot of time thinking about it, setting our strategy, and then working with our business units to carry out that strategy. That maybe TJ can talk about what it's like to be at a big corporation where you have lots of different interest groups. So Boeing is a large corporation, and you know, half of it is defense and half of it's commercial. And setting a strategy that meets both sides of the business can sometimes be very challenging, because especially defense side, there's a lot of budget considerations. On our commercial side, that goes up and down with the global economy. And when we set our environmental strategy for the company 7 years or in 2007, it was one strategy for the entire company and was getting everybody on board to that one direction. And As we were talking about before, one of the things we're talking a little bit more now about is about materiality, what's important to our business, and taking that conversation one step further, that it's not just about doing something that's good for the environment or good for the communities, that it's more than that. It's looking to the future and what's going to have the biggest benefit for all, because that's going to help build a better planet. But
Johnny, you were mentioning earlier about delivering for your customers, your partners, mm-hmm. about making the planes more efficient.
Yep.
You were mentioning that just a moment ago, and also the biofuels. Can you talk a little bit about the importance of that and the progress that Boeing has made in that regard?
Sure. That for our airline customers, having the most efficient product is at the core of their business, that, you know, fuel makes up the majority of their costs. And so one of the ways that they can reduce their costs is to reduce their dependency on fossil fuels. And so I'm sure all of you guys have heard a lot about biofuels. Boeing's been really active in the biofuels field now for about a decade. We've spent a lot of time partnering with competitors, with the airlines, with nonprofits, with educational institutions to prove that biofuels work. And there's been over 1,500 biofuel flights to date. We've proven that it works. You can just drop biofuel right into jet fuel and you can fly the airplane. Now where we need to go is to commercialize it. Boeing's not going to get into the biofuel business, but what we are continuing to do is partner with our airlines and with growers to create sustainable fuel options. And that's a real big growth opportunity for the industry if we can reduce our dependence on fossil fuels. We make up about 5% of the world's GDP and about 2% of the carbon emissions in the world, and so we recognize as an industry we have responsibility to do something about that. Another huge gain opportunity for the industry is to improve the air traffic management system that's in the world. That there's a lot of efficiency gains available on the table, but that requires everyone coming together to partner from each airport, all of the FAA, the FAA equivalents in other countries to all get on board to create a more efficient system. Because if you think about it, if you and I are sitting on the highway, it doesn't matter if you're in a Prius or if you are in a Hummer. If you're both just sitting there in traffic, you're not being fuel efficient. It's the same way with when you get on an airplane. Many of us will get on an airplane tomorrow to go home. If you're sitting there on the tarmac or if you're just circling in the air before you land, the airline customers, they're wasting fossil fuels. So if we can find a way to improve the air traffic management system, you know, there's a double-digit efficiency gain there in reducing carbon emissions that are available today with the technology that Boeing's helping to create. If you guys are interested, I can talk to you guys more about that.
Well, what is stopping that from happening?
I think it's a really complex issue that you have to, if you're going to change the air traffic management system, you really have to get everybody on board, including the government and the FAA, to say, instead of here's the current route structure, you're going to have tailored approaches. And that there was, I think, technology barriers at the beginning. I think we've gotten over those technology barriers, but now it's getting everyone to agree on the new technology, on the new systems, and it's also getting all the individual airports on board for it. I think it's really complex, and I think it takes the airlines pushing for that, the industry to push for that, and competing with all the other topics that the government has to deal with right now.
And what will it take to make it marketable to go with biofuels? I know that Boeing isn't going to be in the manufacturing business for mm-hmm. biofuels, but what will it take for that to become more pervasive throughout the industry? And also, why is it 50-50 mix, biofuel versus Jet A?
So right now, that's just what the approved standard has been, is about 50-50. To get it higher, I think that goes into more of the regulations, and then to get it to a commercial standpoint, that's really would be the airlines really pushing for it, and I think to really get the funding, to get governments to get on board, to help fund some of the additional research, and to figure out what's going to be the most, like, truly sustainable fuel solution for the future, because you don't want to just pick something that's going to have land degradation or it's going to replace food crops, that you want to pick something that's going to make the most sense for each region of the world. And I think that's going to take a lot of effort also by, I think, flying passengers. If we all demanded that our you know, our airplanes were run on biofuels, then our customer, then the airline customers would demand them more, and that would put pressure on the government to fund more of that infrastructure.
The infrastructure at the airport itself.
I think part of that, and also
provide the fuels.
Yep, and then also, you know, taking the fuel source and making it into biofuel and getting that to the airports.
And you mentioned earlier, and then we'll take some questions if you can, that actually regional placement of these fields is critical because it needs to be closer to the airports or perhaps the place where it's manufactured.
Yeah, I think that's we're thinking that that's probably the most likely outcome. Of course, we can't predict the future, but it probably will make the most sense for it to be a regionally based fuel source. That, you know, having say camelina is not going to work for the entire world, or having DeTrofa is not going to work for the entire world. That depending on where you're located, there's probably a sustainable fuel source in that region, and that's most likely what's going to happen. But I think it's still to be determined where the industry is going to go with that.
And are some airlines more aggressive at biofuels than others?
I think so. I think it just depends on the business model. I know we've partnered with several airlines in the past. And that's,
which ones?
Alaska Air is one of them, but there's a laundry list of airlines that are really looking at biofuels, and I think some people are more forward-looking, some people are more of a wait-and-see, but more and more, with over 1,500 flights, more airlines are getting on board with it.
Questions? Yes. Your name and affiliation?
I'm Heather Duncan. I'm a freelancer.
Okay.
I was just, given that this is sort of the last 5 years that you feel like Boeing has, you know, really made this shift, can you speak to what degree sort of the green of Boeing is internally motivated versus motivated by new requirements in Europe and the Department of Defense requirements that they're having to meet as far as their footprint and that kind of thing?
Sure. So the question was, is the greening of Boeing more internally driven or from outside pressures with compliance, and whether it's regulatory coming from the EU or with our defense customers? And so I just wanted to clarify that 5 years ago we set our first external environmental targets. We've had internal targets before, and it's been part of the culture. But in 2007 we formed the Environment, Health, and Safety Group at Boeing, and that was driven by a few things. One of it was the potential risk we saw with compliance changing, and that climate change was becoming more and more of a topic of conversation. And it was something that we realized that we had all these separate groups doing good work, but it wasn't consolidated, and we weren't talking to each other about it. And we needed to come together and set a real strategy for the environment for the entire company. So that was sort of a change of having the defense side being doing one thing, the commercial side doing another, and all coming together to set one environmental strategy. I think in the past, it was really driven about compliance. And we have to change, because if we don't, then this regulation is going to come down and it's going to have a financial impact. Being in the environmental strategy group, it's much more forward-looking than that. Compliance does play a part of it, and we are committed to being compliant and more compliant where it's possible. But it's more about looking at what I was talking about before, looking at the long-term future of what's the best decision. So now the environment is much more important for the defense customers. That's part of the dialogue now. It probably wasn't as big of part of the dialogue 20 years ago. And so that's something that we also come to the table with our customers about, is, have you considered this? When we look at a new product, we're designing in for the environment as well. And that's a benefit that, regardless if you're on the commercial or the defense side, the customers are going to getting that benefit. And it's also having that conversation with the customer, particularly on the defense side, to show that additional benefit. Did I answer your question? Sort of. I'd be happy to talk with you more about it.
Other questions? Okay. Thank you very much. Very much. Joanna, pick up. Thank you. TJ DiCaprio heads up Microsoft's sustainability efforts, and she was the driving force behind Microsoft's recent effort to go carbon neutral by imposing a voluntary internal carbon fee. She's much more eloquent about the details of a very complicated project, but TJ? How about it?
Thank you, Jeff, very much. And I'd like to say one thing. Maybe the next thing we'll see at Boeing is that they'll have the plastic tray tables made out of the garbage from the ocean or something like
that.
So, yeah, start to recycle some of that. Real quick before I start, I just want to thank everyone for actually including me in some of these sessions, not being a journalist. One of the benefits is learning about the journalism rules and what you all are looking for and how you communicate and what your priorities are. I think that we would all benefit greatly to have actually more of us corporate folks or organizational folks better understand the needs of journalists on a regular basis. And so I've learned a lot by participating in the last couple of days and appreciate being included.
DJ, move the microphone real close to your mouth, if you would. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you very much. So I'll talk to you a little bit today about putting a price on carbon for Microsoft, and slightly before I start that, I want to let you know about our overall environmental strategy. And being part of the IT industry, our carbon emissions are actually the same as the airline industry. We're contributing at this point 2% to the global carbon emissions, and that's only increasing as we move to the cloud because of all the increase in the investments in the data centers. And so Microsoft, just about at the same time as Boeing, back in 2007, established an environmental strategy, and it really has three pillars here. And the first pillar is to accelerate radical energy efficiency. How can we support the transition to a low-carbon economy through the use of technology, whether that's managing and storing data very efficiently, bringing transparency to energy consumption, load balancing. And so that's a big priority for Microsoft from certainly a technology perspective. The second is accelerating research breakthroughs. We have a group in Cambridge, England, who primarily focuses on establishing models and using technology, for instance, to identify where there are areas to improve biodiversity and ecosystem conservation. And so that's a group that is driving some pretty interesting projects, and we're actually integrating more of their work into some of the carbon offset projects that I'll address a little bit later. The third pillar is around keeping our own house in order. What does Microsoft need to do with its own operations in order to drive reductions in carbon emission, demonstrating environmental responsibility? And so that's where we're really going to dive a little more deeply in today, because what we found was to cross organizational boundaries, to drive accountability, to basically level set efficiency across the operations, drive operational excellence, carbon turns out to be an incredible metric to do that. The problem with that metric is talking in terms of carbon to business people, as you're all very concerned with messaging and what's relevant, is absolutely not relevant. So what I found was, in talking to the executives or the employees, when I'd speak about pollution, carbon emissions, that would resonate with kind of the green team, but it didn't do me very much good when I was talking to business executives that had to return an ROI on a quarterly basis because of our quarterly earnings. And so suddenly, by putting a price on carbon, I could speak to them in terms of dollars, and it completely changed the whole mix. Suddenly, I wasn't trying to speak English to a French person, where I could wave my hands and speak louder and louder and louder and faster or slower, but they still wouldn't understand me. Suddenly I could resonate and I could speak French to the French people. And what that allowed was the magic of the employees coming together. Well, first of all, they started to come to my meetings. The problem I had at the beginning, too, is not a whole lot of the business people would show up to my pollution carbon reduction meetings because they had other things to do. And then when they would show up, they were doing a lot of email and not paying attention. Well, yeah, it was really infuriating. Actually, it took me about a year to figure out a new way, and that was a driving impetus to move in this direction.
Outlook, but, I presume, when they were sending those emails.
Yes, exactly.
Just checking.
Yeah. And so as it turned out, once we did start to talk about dollars and it had hit the P&L, this internal price on carbon is actually distributed across currently our 14 business divisions, over 110 countries worldwide. So suddenly on the P&L, I have now CFOs from all of our business divisions showing up on, or sending their direct reports but getting the updates, to monthly meetings for task force meetings on a governance, a carbon neutral council, and then having a steering committee. So we stay on the radar of the executives on a very regular basis because they want to know where their money's going.
And what are some of those 14 businesses?
Well, and for instance, it's our online services division. It's Windows. Those are some of them. SQL Server, our product divisions. And then our organization or operational groups like the finance department, HR, legal, that sort of thing. So those are some examples. Thank you very much, Jeff. And so it's been transformational for the organization. And again, it's getting the employees and the brainstorming of the people across the company. And it's actually many of them. It's like my the finance guy for Office 365 came forward and has contributed significant amounts in how we can address efficiency or ways to approach financing for renewable energy. So I'll get into some of that for you. Carbon neutral. Well, the good news, Jeff, you mentioned that we were aiming towards carbon neutrality. Well, we have just completed our first year of our financial cycle. We have achieved carbon neutrality, and so we are now operating carbon neutral, and we'll continue to move that through in that direction moving forward.
When exactly did you have that?
As of July 1, okay. This year, we had operated for a full year under carbon neutral and met that objective. So. And the primary ways we approach this, just to set the foundation for our carbon neutral strategy, is primarily to be lean. We drive load reduction. How can we operate more efficiently? And then how do we green the operations? How do we drive renewable energy, purchasing, on-site development? And then lastly is, for all the unavoidable emissions, how can we offset those in ways that not only reduce carbon but also improve people's lives? And I'll talk a little bit about our priorities, but how can we there improve social communities? How can we empower women? Because when you empower women, you empower a village, and drive education for the youth and to establish jobs. So there's some of the investments that we're using the funds from this carbon fee to make progress in this area. In driving this carbon fee and gaining approval, we had to go across the company and get buy-in from our key revenue-producing groups. And once they got on board and understood the benefits, not only from a citizenship perspective, but also in the messaging and the brand, that's where all of a sudden getting some of these product groups on board, and then we took that up to the CFO who supported it. But our CFO organizationally was one of the key members of this. And I think what is a very important statement going through this whole story is it really actually is a very simple model. And after implementing this now for a year, making it through, setting up the pipes, the infrastructure, running the money through this, one of the things that we'd like to see is having this carbon fee used in different organizations. Because if Microsoft is the only organization that does this, we have limited impact. But the idea is for more and more organizations to actually put an internal price on carbon, cascade it, collect the funds, drive green initiatives so that we can make a real difference in global emissions.
So to make sure I understand this correctly, yeah. Then, so the head of each of your divisions was told, whatever energy, whatever carbon emissions your division creates, you're going to have to pay for that out of your budget. Mm-hmm. If you reduce your carbon emissions, then your budget is benefiting from that, mm-hmm. and or you can buy credits, I suppose. Is that kind of how it works?
Actually, it's simpler than that. It's a consumption model, and so we forecast at the beginning of the year what the carbon emissions will be, and that's where the groups build that into their budgets, their operating budgets, and they actually pay a fee. An example would be, we pay the utility for the electricity we consume. Now we actually pay an incremental fee to offset the pollution, the carbon pollution that's associated with that electricity consumption. Mm-hmm. Same thing for business air travel. So we pay the airline for the ticket. Now we also put into a fund an extra fee in order to offset the pollution associated with that airline travel. And then we use those funds for internal efficiency projects, purchasing renewable energy, accelerating some of these efficiency projects over time, and then as well carbon offset projects. And so this picture will give you a little bit of a visual for where that comes in. Is we establish the price, we cascade that through the different business divisions, and then we collect those funds on a quarterly basis and then disperse them through internal projects, renewable energy, and carbon offset projects. Pretty simple, actually. Some of the business priorities, it was very important to continue and stabilize this fund, actually internally with the executives in the business, was to align this whole effort with our business objectives. And that was a critical messaging factor for relevance. And that is really we're driving the adoption of certainly Microsoft technology to help accelerate this transition to the low-carbon economy. So where can we work with our energy providers, the utilities, in order to be using cloud services either to drive efficiency, load balancing? How can we work then, actually even we're using our own campus as an example, where can you start to drive energy consumption, such as cooling buildings at night when the energy is less expensive, and then during the day having those buildings already start cooled so that we can reduce the energy consumption and the cost during the day. The other areas that I've mentioned that are primarily happening through our carbon offset projects is how can we drive sustainable economic growth and jobs, youth and education, and help solve societal challenges. And these are the primary objectives, business objectives, that are aligned for the use of our carbon funds. So we've got goals for going in by being lean and green, for the consumption, for the charge, and then for the money going out, we actually align with these types of business priorities. And again, the critical component of these is relevancy. This is the way to take a price on carbon and make it relevant to an organization. How can you drive reduce cost by being lean? How can we get more renewable? How can we generate demand and supply of renewable energy for our customers who use our technology? And as devices proliferate and more energy consumption is required for batteries and to run all of our devices, how can we contribute to more renewable energy consumption by, you know, providing that the supply? An example for you for some of the use, and this is driving along the lines of internal efficiency projects, is this is a project that we started on our own campus, and we've already, within the first 6 months of implementation, estimated a 6 to 10% reduction in cost for our energy consumption across our campus. And that campus is 15 million square feet just in Redmond, and then we have another 15 million square feet internationally that we're going to be rolling this technology out. But it provides a dashboard that helps us drive energy efficiency and provides visibility. So it's cloud services that basically provides visibility into the energy consumption, and we can identify faults via this dashboard and find out faults before they get critical, and then we're able to use the carbon fee funds to accelerate fixing problems and driving that, continuing to support driving that efficiency. Another example, and this is sort of the control systems for our real estate and facilities group that takes a look at these dashboards. So it gives you an idea of the kind of information. There's 500,000 data points per day that we take a look at in order to evaluate energy consumption across all the 15 million square feet. So again, you know, certainly from a technology company, that's relevant, as well as how can you use technology and cloud services. In thinking about the green pillar now, as we drive renewable energy, this is an example of a pilot project we're driving where you actually take poop to power. And this is as we basically create methane and use that to power fuel cells in order to drive for our data center energy consumption. And so those are some of the pilot programs we're working on. In addition, some of the news that you're going to be hearing coming out soon is around some of our long-term commitments to power purchase agreement, renewable energy power purchase agreements. So we've got some exciting news about how we are evolving across the company, not only purchasing renewable energy, but also some new carbon offset projects. These are some of the examples of the carbon offset projects that we're using these carbon fee funds for. And again, this is not only carbon reduction and supporting a carbon finance market, but also the additional benefits that come from that, where we are supporting community development, the building of schools, education for the kids, where there are an example, actually, in one of these projects, here's an example again of many of the, there's cook stove projects, renewable energy certainly for some of our international data center sites. We've got methane projects that not only, generate energy, but also employ folks and provide food and farming. So we like to take a look at these projects that have multiple angles, saving wildlife, and so that so that we have many different types of multifaceted, enriched opportunities to make an impact with the use of these funds. The one project is an example, and I'm not going to try to run a video, but there's a link for you on YouTube for this Kasigao project, is in Kenya. It's a fabulous video where we do pay basically for trees, so it's carbon sequestration. And in addition to the money that comes in for those trees, we actually are able to fund the building of a factory where the local community goes to work in this factory and they create clothes and sell them to Puma. And then in addition, the funding is used and the women are now having jobs and an income, and they are able to build the schools where now their kids are getting education for the first time, and you can see that in the video. And they employ the men in the forests that are now generated and preserved and conserved against, and they go against the poachers. And so instead of now chopping down the trees to create the charcoal that they sell for fuel, they actually trim the trees to make the charcoal and to sell the fuel. So it's evolving these cultures in emerging nations and helping accelerate the transition to a low carbon economy in these areas while providing some social and community welfare.
And DJ, I want to save time for some questions too.
So okay. Continue. All right. And this will be a wrap. Here's a couple more links. The first white paper talks about the carbon neutral and initiating the journey across our environmental sustainability. The second talks about corporate policies and public policies and how we can interact, because certainly we want to set an example for how public policy, certainly in the United States, could take this as a best practice. And then a paper that I'm going to be publishing within the next month is pretty much an inspiring document for what is a carbon fee, why implement it, and then all of the details and the particulars to actually set this up.
Okay, so I'm going to open up for some questions. Go ahead, Sharon. Well, I was going to talk about, do you want to address the issue of the price that you set for carbon and also the transparency of how that is implemented?
Yes, absolutely. Well, we've got a pricing strategy. And initially what I needed to do when we started this process was to go to a finance person, to go to a chief financial officer and say, I want to charge a certain amount, and this is what I need to do with the funds. So the price was based on the use of the funds. I had to have money coming in equaling money going out in a very simple fashion. And I had to show what we were using that money for and what we were buying. And so at the very start of the program, it was the price was set based on the purchase of renewable energy, whether it was through market RECs. And now as we're evolving through the renewable energy credits that are from long-term new wind development, and also the price that we were paying for the carbon offset projects. That's evolving over time now to also include the price that we are that it costs or the charge for internal efficiency projects. So my point is that we started very simple and we started very low because it was critical not to shock the system. And we are evolving the price over time. We actually, since then, I've found the model in the UK, British Columbia, they actually set an initial price at $5, and then they've incrementally increased their price approximately $5 every year over the last 5 years or so. We are taking a very similar approach. We have not published the actual price on carbon, and I have to wait for probably another 6 months to be able to do that because of the complicated nature of the way we started with the pricing structure. I had to show the CFO that we are charging a certain price relevant to offset the energy for the U.S., and that's a different price than offsetting the energy consumed internationally, and that's a different price than the business air travel. So I'm balancing between specificity, which is where we are now, to simplicity. And if I gave you a blended price, it wouldn't reflect really what the price is in different areas. So the transparency element is we will be coming out with that as we evolve this, because I've got to stabilize the financial group so that we can actually provide a number that accurately reflects the price. Having said that, I think that the UK model certainly can give you a good indication of an example.
Yes, Ashley.
Yeah. Ashley Hearn, KUW, in your hometown. I had a couple questions. So, I understand you can't give us a hard figure for how much
the carbon is costing, but I think you can understand why journalists really want it
numbered. Absolutely, yes.
And I wonder, did you have baseline data before you started this initiative to really show what the impacts might be? And can you talk a little bit about whether or not you're seeing a reduction in the CO2 emissions from Microsoft?
Yeah, absolutely. So the baseline, yes, we started our carbon baseline on emissions. I want to make sure I'm covering the right topic, okay, because there's always so many different baselines that I can come at. Baseline on emissions, we started tracking our emissions in 2009 for an inventory, and we actually started and then went back to 2007. We had an initial goal that was reducing carbon emissions 30% by 2012. We did meet that goal through a series of initiatives, but what happened then was our business strategy shifted to the cloud. Because of our increase in energy consumption and the investments in the data centers, what we realized was our carbon footprint is only increasing. So we can incrementally decrease it through efficiency measures, which we are driving. But the problem was we're a significant contributor to carbon emissions from an industry sector perspective, and our customers are also now with the proliferation of devices. So there was really no alternative but to go, at least in our own operations, carbon neutral. You know, I mean, we could reduce a certain amount, but it was really how much were we going to pay to do that, and we needed to be responsible to go 100%. And so we've done that. Now our next step, when we look forward, is really how can we start working, of course, with our supply chain, and then as well down the other side of the stream is with our customers. You know, we design our software now to drive power efficiency and better products as we go through Windows 7, Windows 8, our efficiency is going up as in the studies that we've done. So it's a matter now of expanding that reach. And that was as far as the benchmarking. I'm so sorry. What was the second? Yeah.
As Washington considers a carbon tax or a trade system, how would that affect your operations internally? Or what's your stance on it?
Yeah, we would just continue at ourselves as well, because what it is it's an internal view of driving efficiency. And what's happened, the success has been that the finance group just loves this because it gives them another approach to go and say, yes, we want to reduce costs. Yes, we want to reduce costs in carbon. And carbon actually turns out to be a very leveling factor to drive operational excellence, because I can talk about business air travel, and yes, we want to reduce T&E, but it's the carbon levels. When we take a look at those graphs, it's carbon that can tell us the indicator of travel, which is T&E, and it also at the same time can show us the big, huge spike in energy consumption over time as we develop our data centers. And so while it's a leveling factor, it's by putting a price on it, it integrates into the financial structure so we get attention. And also the education and awareness over this first year has been incredible. So the other question that you actually had was, are we seeing the reduction? And what we are we're actually getting much more positive results than I anticipated. The first year, and again, it's a journey. The first year I had actually just set expectations that this was around education and awareness. Off the charts, got that. We've got brainstorming and people coming together talking about new ways to do things that we never would have thought before. And to have my naysayers, which were in particular groups, they're the first ones to turn around and come back and say, oh my gosh, this is a unifying factor across the organization for us to even uplift opportunities to drive energy efficiency. And that's the facilities group, you know, and they wouldn't have had that any other way. And so, also, turning this carbon fee from a sort of a tax concept and punitive into something that was really positive, like to our facilities group, some of the naysayers, suddenly to say, oh, we're going to contribute some of these funds to help you accelerate energy efficiency so you can drive benefit for the company and value in reducing costs. Suddenly they, you know, I've got more requests now for energy efficiency projects than we actually allocated budget. So the benefit there, and this is the strategy, is to take that demand and value to the company back to the finance team and say, you know what, if we increase the price on carbon $1, $5, suddenly look at the money we have that we can generate because it has demonstrated value to drive additional cost reduction on this side of the house.
How do you feel about the state of Washington's carbon fee idea?
Personally, I think that it can only benefit us all, you know. And I think what's important for us to consider is how the funds are used. When we collect the funds, how are they used, and are they used to drive more efficiency and renewable energy in new areas? I know we have a lot of hydro in the area, but how can we drive and use those funds for environmental reasons? I wouldn't like to see the funds used for improvements on roads.
Yeah.
You know, because then it should just be a road tax, you know.
Yes, sir.
Definitely so. There are energy efficiency metrics now assigned into commitments for all of our facilities folks, and that is something new. That did not happen before. And so meeting commitments is the basis for how you get your bonuses and how your reward structure is set up. So we are seeing, because of this awareness and education, we are seeing more and more incentive package returns now within the groups. We also have awards that we give out quarterly for a variety of different topics, whether it's subsidiary level or just general, either it's an energy efficiency or any type of environmental awards. And those are usually contributions to charities. And now we're actually figuring out a new award system where we can send our employees out to visit some of these carbon offset projects in order to participate and do work out remote in some of these projects to help them as well. So it's starting to happen.
Yeah, go ahead. And then you
My name is Martha. I'm a journalist student at Michigan State University. And you know, can I have a question for Erin?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Go ahead.
I was just curious, you were talking about how like the motivation, like there has to be a motivation in the whole company, and that maybe like his motivation was for the environment, and he tried to get the whole of me and staff. And it looks like TJ, like you seem to be really driven by the environment. You have to like start talking about money to get the other people in the company into it. So they seem to be more driven by saving money or budgets. So how do you think about the different approaches you can? Can it be done also in with this motivation?
That's a good question. Yes, and by the way, I'm a Spartan, so go Spartans, undergrad. So I mean, I think, look, it started with a really inspirational guy in our company, but nobody else started there. So in the early days, we talked about things like waste with the operations guys. We talked about things like energy efficiency with the CFOs and our finance teams. So in the early days, it was sort of about getting them over the hump. And you need to speak probably 15 different languages internally to 15 different stakeholders, I think, to get them on board. But the other thing that we did, because I think you acknowledge that when you set the bar really high and you try to motivate people, you get amazing results. So I would say companies who are setting incremental goals are completely missing the boat. Because you know, President Kennedy said, we're going to the moon. And the enormity of that challenge got so many people in our country focused on the fact, the dream, the inspiration. If he had said, we're just going to fly the shuttle to California, right, it would make it to California. So I really feel like the enormity of the vision that our founder set had a lot to do with generating how far we've gotten. I mean, you know, I'm not going to go into the metrics. You guys can talk, you can see on our website, but we've reduced GHG emissions over 80% in the company in 20 years. And we haven't done it because we said we were going at 10% or 20%. So I feel like that motivation piece is really important. And how you get to it is you do talk the language of a bunch of people, but you also get really bold. And you bring people along. And the other thing is you make really specific investments, and our CEO used to call it, like, getting weird. So there were times when we sent our designers out into the forest with the woman who heads up the Biomimicry Guild. And they were like, what are we doing? You know, we're observing how nature makes a floor. And we're like, just go do it. Just do it. Trust us. So I think you have to... In addition to sort of how you drive that, when it's not just one guy, is you make really targeted investments around motivating people that are very different. So,
5 minutes left.
You guys want to?
Yeah, I guess just more on Ashley's question, a little more specific. Mm-hmm. You said that the emissions reductions thus far is much greater than you had anticipated, but can you be a little?
Yes, sorry.
Since you moved the target or the goal, what is the goal now? Is it totally neutrality by
Actually, we are operating carbon neutral now. We started the goal for our fiscal year 13, and we've just completed that fiscal year. And so we were able to, through the combined efforts of driving energy efficiency, the example like with the campus project, it's called 88 acres, between efficiency projects and then purchasing renewable energy, building on-site locations for renewable energy, and carbon offset projects for the rest. Yes, we've hit that carbon neutral goal, and so now we consistently operate carbon neutral. What I can't tell you is specifically the reduction from fiscal year 12 to fiscal year 13, because we actually haven't finalized all those numbers. We're in the midst of getting the actual emissions. One of the things about emissions or that you get them from, like, energy bills, and in many parts of the world, your energy bills are 2 or 3 months late, so we still haven't calculated all the actual emissions for our fiscal year 13, but we're in the process of collecting that information now. The point being, too, is the first year in, I actually don't think I'll see radical efficiency gains and carbon emission reductions over that year, because we've just started the project. So I don't want to set expectations that the first year out that we're going to see it, because they're just learning about what this is. What I do expect to see is, first, Microsoft's carbon emissions are only going to increase because we're building data centers all over the world. And over the next few years, you're going to see those emissions increase because of our energy consumption is going to increase because we're building these data centers to serve our customers. The good news is that we are operating these data centers more efficiently than customers on-premise in their own individual areas. So global emissions, and continuing to do studies to update this, will increase at a lower rate because we're driving more efficiency. But absorbing those carbon emissions from our customers is something that we are taking very seriously, and therefore driving the carbon neutral pledge, even incorporating those, so that when those emissions are unavoidable for the growth, that's where we invest in these carbon offset projects in order to help emerging nations develop in a low carbon economy. So I hope that kind of balances it.
Sure, and I wish I had said this before. So Boeing this year just announced we had just finished our first set of five-year environmental targets, and this year we set our new internal environmental target, which is carbon neutral growth. We haven't talked about it at all, so I don't have a presentation, I don't have a plan to show everyone, but we have pledged our operations carbon neutral growth from here on out. So part of the way we're going to do that is very similar to the way Microsoft does it, is with the purchase of renewable energy credits and then project operational efficiencies, and then also with all new construction being LEED silver certified or greater, that's also going to get us there. But over the past 5 years, from 2007 to 2012, our airplane deliveries increased by over 50%. And our business is just projected to continue to grow. And so just like with Microsoft, our operational carbon emissions will continue to grow, but we've realized that we needed to take something better than an incremental target. That was good for the business for the first 5 years as we learned more and more on the journey. And then we could have done, okay, well, over the next 5 years, we're going to continue to reduce by 1% every year. And we just decided to draw a line in the sand from here on out, carbon neutral growth. So part of that will be renewable energy credits. We'll probably see more. Our factory in South Carolina is 100% renewable energy. We have facilities in over 70 countries, and our employees are located in over 70 countries. In some of those locations, renewable energy is not possible. So, like in the Pacific Northwest, you know, we have hydro is a huge source of our energy. In some countries, the only energy powering electricity is coal. In those sort of cases, then we'd purchase renewable energy credits to help that. But it's going to be a combination of driving more and more efficiency in our current operations, getting our factories more efficient, getting our office buildings more efficient, getting our employees more educated on reducing the amount of electricity they use. Simple things like turning off your computer monitor. We have over 170,000 employees. Not every one of them has a computer monitor, but a lot of them do. So turning off your computer at night makes a measurable impact. So it's going to be little things like that to large scale projects like installing a solar panel roof on our factory in South Carolina.
We're almost out of time, so we'll take one more from you. Okay, there's a new person in the back. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, sure. My name is Elizabeth Hammett, and I'm the Administrator of Environmental Policy at EPD, and which is our local electricity distributor. Uh-huh. And I had a question for any of you, really. You mentioned that you saw a lot of employee engagement, customer loyalty. Did anyone find a way to measure that or to quantify those benefits?
I mean, you know, I think when you talk about sort of the intangibles related to employee engagement, you can certainly measure percentage of employees that are highly engaged. And so if you do something like a Gallup or a series of surveys, it definitely shows. We did a project a year and a half ago where we took a documentary film crew to every single factory, and we interviewed those people who were super highly engaged in sustainability, and found out that those are also the people who are the most productive. They lead the safety teams. They're huge advocates in the community. So right now, based on that project, we're developing a set of metrics based on what we learned from our people to try to see not just how does it influence our direct benefit as the company, like longer tenure, safer, better productivity, but what's the ripple effect? Because we often found that when they learned it at Interface, they took it home, they took it to communities. So we're trying to sort of develop some metrics there. Mm-hmm. All I can say is it's a pilot.
Providing the funds from the carbon fee into these initiatives, what we see are the employers are coming up with ways to drive efficiency in different projects. And even if it's not efficiency, it's, you know, getting the bicycles available to ride instead of commuting. And so they've come up with sort of getting rid of bottled water. It's amazing what engaged employees contribute to the company to change the culture.
If you want, I'll just give you what we're measuring.
Yeah, which transitions us to after questions after the session. We're out of time, but I want to thank Aaron Meason from Interface, Joanna Pickup from Boeing, TJ DiCaprio from Microsoft. Let's hear it for them.
Pleasure.